Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. In this talk, delivered on March 8th as part of Winter Weekend 2014, Gregory Fries presents Dostoevsky and Russian Orthodoxy. Fries is a professor of history at Brandeis, where he teaches courses on 19th and 20th century Russian and German history. In this talk, Fries discusses the background of religious belief that surrounded Dostoevsky's world, even when it does not appear directly in his novels.
Okay, so I'm not a Dostoevsky scholar. I'm basically a social historian, because I believe in the people. And that's what I wanted to study, right? So if you're going to study the Russian people, that means you study the Russian church. Right? Just to give you some numbers, in 1914 in Germany, people going to communion was about 30% of the Lutheran parishioners. In Berlin, it was about 10%. Among the Catholics in France, it was 20-25%. In Paris, 15%. I mean, this is what was described as secularization. Decline, de-Christianization is the alternative terminology, which is widely used. In Russia, 1914, not 30, but 90% took communion. 1914. 8% missed for good excuse, they were sick or traveling. 2% were indifferent. Right? So one of the fundamental facts about Russian religious life is the pervasive continuity of popular orthodoxy right through 1917 and well after that. And it's very striking from the rest of Europe. At the same time, even though Russia does not have those numbers that terrified bishops all across Western Europe, second important point to bear in mind is the transconfessionality, transnationality of religious thought and experience in the 19th century. Even though the Russians didn't have the Westerners' problems, the Western Church's problems, they studied the Western Church very carefully. And you could open any theological or religious journal and you will find a section about Western Europe and the churches there and what's going on. And so they're trying to anticipate problems and solve them before they get in the mess that the Europeans regard themselves as being in. So what I'm going to talk about today is to give you some sort of this religious context. You can open almost any Russian history textbook, and after the Petrine reforms of 1721, the church disappears. You'd be hard put to find out what religion these people belong to. Right? It just simply disappears. Books on 1917 go over hundreds of pages, and not a single mention of the church and clergy. You usually come with the view that it's a moribund, dead institution, unwilling and unable to change. Basically, what I'm going to try to suggest today is that things are changing at a frenetic pace beginning in the mid-19th century, basically by a valoration and approval, a foregrounding of popular orthodoxy. What we spent a century from 1750 onwards of trying to purify, to make, as the Synod said in 1775, people believe, but they don't know what they believe in. So they tried to turn them into self-conscious Orthodox. Well, beginning in 1850, the Russian church, like the Western churches, began to appreciate the importance of popular Catholicism, popular Lutheranism, and in this case, popular Orthodoxy. And instead of repressing, you try to mobilize, to valorize, to recognize, to allow local saints, to allow lots of icon processions. You didn't allow them in the 1840s because everybody ended up stone drunk. After 1850, you begin to appreciate this is one way of getting them out, right? And if they get drunk, they get drunk. But the point is, you recognize that this is, you're giving them recognition. And one of the main themes of my research is basically the laicization of Russian Orthodoxy. From 1850 to 1988, roughly, the Russian Orthodox Church with a capital C, meaning the bishops, the institution, and the clergy, Russian Orthodox Church with capital C, became the Russian Orthodox Church with a small c, the parish. In 1917, the parishioners, not the clergy, ran the church. And that will remain the case throughout the Soviet period, whether it was legal or underground, that was the case. And this explains the continuing vitality of Orthodoxy in Russian culture. 80% say that they are believers. After 1991, about 5 to 10% actually belong to a parish church. But they believe. And in Western scholarship, this is called, after Sarah Davies' research, this is called believing without belonging. Right? And if you transferred that, I mean, Orthodoxy is parish Orthodoxy in all of its myriad forms, local rites, local saints, customs, some of them blatantly non-Christian. But nevertheless, that's where the power is. Okay, so today, basically four main themes I would like to suggest to you. First, I would briefly talk about the scholarship. This, since 1991, there's been a tremendous amount of research on Dostoevsky's religious views, often without much knowledge of what the Orthodoxy of the Church are all about, which is what I'm going to suggest to you today. And the second main point is to provide that context on the Orthodox revival beginning in the 1860s. One of the, I think Bill Todd mentioned, the great reforms, well, that's talking about emancipation of serfs, that's talking about judicial system, censorship, et cetera, et cetera. The Church had paralleled great reforms in the 1860s, intending to revitalize, modernize the Church and making it much more effective in performing its functions. The third basic point is about Dostoevsky's pious childhood, which he talks about in 1873. But by the 1850s and 60s, clearly he has become de-Christianized, or at least de-Orthodoxized. He doesn't take communion after 45. And in 1854, writes a very famous letter, which if you open any text dealing with the Dostoevsky religion, it's inevitably quoted, saying, "I'm a child of my age, which is a disbelief and doubt. And I'll probably stay that way till I die." And that's the kind of attitude he has in the 50s and 60s. In Crime and Punishment, basically, I'm going to suggest that there basically is no institutional church there. You have one priest who's giving last rites. But basically, the church is a non-factor, a non-existent element there, and we'll see that statistically. But there is popular Orthodoxy, and he's managed to pick up on this change, and it's everywhere in the 1850s, 50s, and especially 60s. Discovery of the folk, ethnography, history. Until this time, you wrote histories of the Russian state. Begin in 1860s, you write history of the Russian people, history of the Russian peasantry. We have ethnographies appearing as profession in the 60s and 70s. Vladimir Dial does his famous four-volume dictionary of the great Russian language, which you're going to talk about real language, not just the literary language, but that have been collected in the past. Okay, scholarship on Dostoevsky's religious views. I guess the first thing to say would be that before 1917, there wasn't much attention to this. And people say he's Orthodox or not Orthodox, he's a heretic or whatnot, but there wasn't much attention paid to it. You can open religious journals and you won't find Dostoevsky there. You can open the 14-volume Orthodox Theological Encyclopedia, you won't find Dostoevsky there. After 1917, he begins to be discovered mainly in the West, first among the émigrés. The émigré literature foregrounds this. There's a very conservative bishop who published a book in 1921 talking about Dostoevsky's religious views. And this begins to gain greater and greater currency, especially in Western literature, the 70s and 80s. In 1984, for example, this one scholar studied all of the notations on Dostoevsky's New Testament. He analyzed them and tried to figure out what they tell you about his thinking in the early 50s. In the Soviet Union, what religion, right? I mean, you print God with a small G when you publish him. I mean, basically, try to forget that this guy had any religious views whatsoever. And that's a bit hard to do when you get into the 70s. But he made heroic attempts to just simply ignore this altogether. Since 1991, this has been the boom industry, right? And in Russia, for example, there are journals called the Gospels in Russian literature in the 18th and 19th century. A whole series of publications very specialized about the image of Easter in Dostoevsky, et cetera, et cetera. In the Western scholarship, a number of monographs on, for example, Ivanitsa's book on Dostoevsky and believers. Another one on just a couple of studies on Dostoevsky's religious views, passive religious views in Crime and Punishment, and so forth and so on. So the tremendous boom of interest in trying to figure out what the religious element was. And Dostoevsky himself basically has this very religious upbringing. He talks about it in 1873, and his mother in particular went to church, of stuff up to the age of 10 at least. Went on pilgrimages each year to the monastery and whatnot. So he had this kind of religious upbringing. When you look at it a little bit closer, it's a bit more bizarre. His favorite book is very widespread, is a Protestant German book on Bible stories. And it pops up in Brothers Karamazov. It was one of my German students when I taught in Germany called the Brothers Kalashnikov. He made an impression, I must say. So you have that appearing in his family upbringing. But then when he goes to St. Petersburg in the 40s, he clearly became, as he himself describes, less religious. He's associating with people who are very hostile to the church and clergy. And he doesn't, there's a number of some evidence that he didn't like what was being said about Christ, but you could pick on the clergy and the clergy to cows come home, that's fine. In 50, he goes to the Siberian exile, and it's there on the way that someone gives him a New Testament, an 1823 text that was given to him, in which for 4 years it's the only book he's allowed to have. And he makes all kinds of notations in it, for example, comparing text, similar text, or he would take his fingernail because he'd have something to write with and mark it down. But if you think you have now a budding Luther, you think again, because he also asked for his brother to send him copies of the Quran. So, you know, it was Kant and whatnot. And in the 1860s, he comes back to St. Petersburg in 61, and through the 60s, we've heard all about his various publishing efforts and financial problems, and goes abroad to hide from the debtors. But basically, you find, if you look at the concordance of the index to his 30 volumes, what's striking is almost no references to church, clergy before the 1860s. In 1968, 69, they begin to see a few things. But before then, it's as though that church and clergy did not exist. And part of that, I think, reflects sort of the attitude of the day. This is a Hübner book, which was published in 1715. And in German, it's called 2x52 Bible Histories. So they produce an arithmetic. So it's and in Russian, when it was published in 1787, it's called 104 Bible Stories. It appeared three or four times. So it was either he had enough for 2 years or he did two a week. I don't know what the goal was. But we have it had the Luther Bible, and it would have questions and then moral lessons to be drawn from it in each of these stories. So that's very, very characteristic. Throughout the 18th and 19th century, there's a big input of Protestant, German Protestant influence inside the Russian church. Like the most famous saint we'll talk about in a moment, his favorite book was Johann Arndt's True Christianity, published in 1613, and one of the most famous Protestant religious tracts of the period. That's a copy of Dostoevsky's New Testament. It was published in 1823. From 1816 to 23, there was a Russian Bible Society initiated in England, and you published about 700,000 copies of the New Testament, either Russian only or with the Church Slavonic. To explain, by Russian only means modern Russian. Right? Church Slavonic is very difficult for most people to read and make sense of. So from 16 to 23, you published about 700,000 copies, and one of them ends up in Siberia in 1850 in his Now, when he comes to St. Petersburg, this is really the height of anti-clericalism. Right? So you have this group of painters who are very avant-garde, and they're called the Itinerants. One's called the Rural Icon of Procession. So that gentleman on the porch is a priest, and it's a custom that you go to each house, you know, you bless the house, and they give you a glass of vodka. Well, after a few houses, it begins to take hold. That corpse underneath the porch is the deacon. Who obviously has a less of a tolerance. So you have a lot of this anti-religious literature, paintings and so forth going. In literature, you have the seminarian genre. You describe how horrible life is for these Russian Orthodox seminarians. Here's another one of Tiet, this Moscow environs, and that's a very un-anorexic monk ignoring these poor people. So we have a lot of this kind of stuff. Now, just to put, this is Vasily Petrov, one of the most famous itinerant painters. About a decade later, he did the Dostoevsky. Okay, context, dynamic orthodoxy in the 1860s. There are basically five things I want to mention. first is the institutional great reforms. And with that, I mean a whole number of things, but basically you want to revitalize these institutions. And for example, you got to do something like at the seminaries. Terrible curriculum, bad conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we improve Russian seminaries? We go study Catholic seminaries in Paris and get ideas from the West. It's a very clear attempt to borrow from the West. Another reform. We need to get the parish to become more active in supporting Christians. Well, what do we do? Well, you know what the Germans are doing. They have now established church councils. Kirchenrat. Church councils. Why don't we have a parish Soviet? And then one guy says, well, that sounds a little bit Protestant. Maybe we better get a different name. Trusteeship councils that they eventually settled upon. But the idea is to empower the parishioners. You have a committee of activists who would raise funds for the church, the clergy, parish schools. The church is very heavily engaged in the expansion of public education for boys and girls. And the last reform I'd mention would be the parish clergy, which in Russia was a hereditary caste. All sons are sons of priests. Not all sons become priests. Chernyshevsky, Golubov, a very famous Popovichi, who end up in secular careers. But the only way to become a priest was to go to the seminary. The only way to go to seminary was to be the son of a priest. Right? So that's just the way it ran. So one of the reforms is basically to secularize the children of the clergy. They no longer have automatic clerical status, and they are encouraged to pursue other lines. So within a decade, 1% of the population accounts for 35% of university students. Now, that part worked, letting the sons go. The other part didn't work so well. No one ran. You opened the doors to the barn. All the horses ran off, but no horses ran in. So by the 70s, you have a problem. You don't have enough candidates, right? Because if you have any education at all, you're not going to become a priest. It's poorly paid, dependent on parishioners, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So in 1860, every priest had a 12-year classical education. By 1880, you're desperate to find candidates. You're now ordaining people who attended the seminary, didn't complete it. The second element is intellectual, the new directions in Christian theology. And without boring you to tears with all of this, the main thing is a new Christology. Namely, and this is borrowed from German Protestant theology, the idea is that the church must go into the world as Christ did. The church must become engaged in philanthropy, education, poor relief, fighting prostitution, etc., etc. The church's goal is not otherworldly, it is thisworldly. And so if you go to the main theological journals of the late 50s and 60s, they're talking about progress, and about the worldly role of the church. It's a direct line from here to 1917, when virtually the entire clergy welcomed the February Revolution. A third theme is popular, and I mentioned it in the very beginning, which is now you begin to valorize, appreciate popular orthodoxy. You don't seek to transform it, but to co-opt it. For example, you study all these local saints who are not official saints. There are hundreds of them. And you gradually begin running canonization processes to canonize these saints. One person is canonized in the 19th century. Six are canonized in the early 20th. And many more are in stages of preparation of canonization. What does that mean? That means what's a criterion? Well, two criteria. Traditionally was they didn't stink, right? They died, but they smelled like roses. That's traditional popular view. The second criterion is they have to be venerated by the people and to be the cause of miracles. So you investigate to make sure that the blind actually were blind before they could now see, et cetera, right? You have to verify medically that these miracles, the inexplicable miracles, have taken place. You begin to encourage icon processions, which you had discouraged before. All these kinds of things. And better that they practice popular orthodoxy than none at all. And so in the 1840s, in the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church in the West, you begin doing this even earlier, allowing processions and so forth as a way of bringing religion into public space, and hopefully recruiting, persuading, demonstrating the power of the church and religion. A fourth theme is parish empowerment. And basically, from 1864 on, the parish now is going to run the church, increasingly so. There are a whole number of things go into this, but what it basically means is the laity now run the parish. Not the bishop, not the priest, but the laity. The church fights this tooth and nail because they regard themselves as trained, properly trained clergymen with a full education and so forth. And from 1861 onwards, they're resistant to this, allowing the laity to take control. But by 1917, to paraphrase Lenin, it was not all power to the Soviets, but all power to the parish Soviets. And in 1918, Lenin dissolved the church as an institution. The big C no longer exists. Can't sue, can't be sued. Cannot have an administration. Cannot have any treasury, et cetera, et cetera. And Lenin, ironically, gave all power to the C, to the church, to the small C. Only the parishioners now could lease the church and run that church. The upshot of all that, as I've argued elsewhere, is that basically over the next decade or so, there's a revival, a resurgence of religious belief and practice. Rates go up, not down, to the horror of the Bolsheviks. This was not what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to wither away. And in fact, we have just the opposite kind of consequence. And the last thing I would emphasize is feminization of Orthodoxy. Now, again, as a Europeanist, I emphasize this is a pan-European phenomenon. You go to France, Germany, or elsewhere in Western Europe, you find that the women play an ever greater role in vocations, right? French, Russian, German monasticism is feminized. Most new recruits are women, not men. So that by 1900, close to 80% of all Russian monastics are female. And you also see it reflected in power. Women, by the 1890s, have a greater role in these parish councils. They can be elected chairman. That's horrible for women, people to realize that they were going to be chairman. In 1918, because there's so few male clergy, women now can aid in assistant services as leaders, right, what had previously been the role of the chairwoman. So, but basically, what I would emphasize is also the Marian cult takes off. Female Russian saints proliferate, all these kinds of things, which valorize and recognize the role of women in what is an overwhelmingly patriarchal organization, where only males can be ordained. But you begin cutting corners on that one. Look at what the Germans did. They established deaconesses in the 1860s, which is a semi-clerical order. 1912, Russia does the same thing, the deaconess movement. 1914, the Women's Theological Institute, to enable these women to get a full theological education. They play a big role in the clerical press. If you look at the correspondence between leading clergy, it's often with women who now emerge as prominent religious writers. Okay, so basically, as a Russian church historian, I would look at Dostoevsky in the 60s, and what's he got to say about the church? Nothing. He could have been on Mars, basically, and couldn't have said less. Basically, if you look at his index, there's almost none of the famous people of the 60s, the famous writers, clergy, bishops, appear. He had some journals, theological journals in his library, two sets, not very much. But basically, if you look at his index, it really begins in the late 60s when he begins to discover the church and what's going on. Right? So if we quantify Crime and Punishment and Mother's Day, he's found something, right? He's begun churching and recognizing. But you could go up almost any parameter. The only sort of odd thing is that secular priest, and that's because Marmeladov gets last rites. And Sonia's stepmother hates clergy. So she makes a few nasty remarks about them. But basically, there's not, you're looking for explicit Orthodox references to communion, confession, you won't find it. No reference to epithymia, which is public penance. Until 1851, Raskolnikov would have got punished twice. He would have had his secular punishment, plus he would have gotten public penance, which would mean a number of years incarcerated in a monastery after he does his secular stint until 1851. 1851, epithymia, or public penance, is abolished. And this is St. Tikhon of Zadonsk, who was canonized the year Dostoevsky in St. Petersburg. Now, you'd have to be absolutely blind, deaf, not to hear what's going on. It's everywhere. Not a reference until the late 60s, when he begins to discover Tikhon as an archetypical elder, extra-institutional. Tikhon basically is famous because he was a bishop, very micromanaging type bishop. And after about 4 years as bishop, he resigned to concentrate fully on prayer and spiritual life, and he's a kind of counter-institutional prelate. Someone who rejects official ecclesiastical status in the name of purely spiritual affairs. He appears in Dostoevsky's references from the late 60s, but not before then. All right, there is some popular orthodoxy in the Crime and Punishment. The first is this female lay piety, the pious prostitute. Right? From the very beginning, he gets the Lazarus story from Sonia. And, I mean, if you said, how about something on female religiosity, she'll go, he did it, right? I mean, this is really, I mean, you see these religious female figures proliferating and symbolizing true popular orthodoxy, and increasingly playing a greater role in the church itself. In the second, you have a bit in there on schismatics, what they call schismatics, old believers, and sectarians. And there's not much here, but it's already a big issue in the 60s, because under Russian law until 1905, you could convert to, but not from, Orthodoxy. Until 1905, you could convert to Orthodoxy, from Judaism, Catholicism, Lutheranism, whatever, but you couldn't go back. Right? So if you had second thoughts, too bad. Right? You're in, and you're in for good. So you'd be prosecuted for apostasy. Right, until 1905, April 17th, 1905, when freedom of religious conscience means that you can convert away from Orthodoxy without penalty. But the gist of it is, from 1860 to 1905, there's a growth of sectarian old believer movements. Some people estimate them at 10% of the population, but clearly they are proliferating. You see them appearing, you know, in Tolstoy's Father Sergius, for example. But in the public space, there's a great deal of discussion that the greatest threat is not de-Christianization, but re-Christianization. The greatest threat is not de-Christianization, rejecting Christianity, but re-Christianization to one of these alternative forms of Christianity. And the third thing is what I would call the gospelization of Russian life. Until, I told you, 1816-23, you published the Bible in Russian. In 1857, right, the beginning of the Great Reforms, one of the first decisions made is, we've got to publish the Bible in Russian and distribute it. 1860, the New Testament appears in a cheap 2-ruble, what was it, 20 rubles to get a thick journal, 2-ruble edition, the New Testament. 1876, the whole Bible appears for the first time in modern Russian. Before this, the only full Bible you could get was these huge things which were intended for church services to be read from. They're basically the size and weight of a small compact car. There's no way Colporteur is going to be bringing a bunch of those down the pike. So, but you've basically now disseminated the Bible in ways which was unthinkable before. There had been illegal underground Bibles coming in from the West before this, but now it's legal, cheap, small size, widely distributed, and part of this profusion of ecclesiastical publications in the 60s and 70s. I might add a footnote that it must be in Russian, could be in Alaotian, it could be in Chirimis, but it cannot be in Ukrainian. So in 1865, someone presented a text of the New Testament to Ukrainian and asked permission to publish it. And they said, no, you may not. So the Ukrainian Bible does not legally appear until 1905, where basically censorship goes away. Why? I think we can explain why we get this pattern in Dostoevskyism, in the first hand, to emphasize the censorship. There is not only state censorship, which has become somewhat more liberal, but also ecclesiastical censorship. If you quote biblical texts, if you portray clergy, you are vulnerable to ecclesiastical censorship. And a number of things are interdicted by this church censorship. So he's already had trouble with censors, so he may be a little bit gun-shy about even touching upon that, therefore avoids it. But secondly, I think he's picked up on this new emphasis on popular orthodoxy, on its legitimacy and validation. Let me sum up on all that by saying that, first of all, this recent scholarship has unearthed an enormous amount of very specialized studies, but mostly on the post-1869 writings, right? Linking his writings with his notebooks and so forth. Second big theme is intellectual, that there are new directions in Orthodox theology, one which is this-worldly, not otherworldly, which is the whole purpose is the clergy and the church should have a this-worldly role and therefore accord more power and responsibility to the laity. The third big theme is feminizing Orthodoxy. If you look at the writings, if you look at the valley, at the locations in particular, right? This huge increase in female monasticism, their prominence in ecclesiastical press, their legal status in the church. One of the first decisions in the church council of 1917-18 would be the status of women in the church. And though they can't cross the threshold of ordaining women, they've begun to cut corners with the deaconess in 1912, the female theological institute in 1914, and by permitting women to serve as priest's aides after 1918. And we now know that in the 30s and 40s, when the church was subjected to tremendous repression, something like 40% of the people sent to the camps were so-called serfovniki, church people. And serfovniki meant, by the 1930s, lay activists. Lay activists. We now find that women were performing sacraments because there was no one else to do it. And that will persist right through the 70s and 80s. And the last point of my basic argument here is that we find echoes of this popular orthodoxy, which he's picked up on, right, which is not vulnerable in terms of censorship, but completely oblivious to the church and clergy, partly reflecting the anti-clericalism. Right? The term anti-clerical appears in French in 1854. It appears in Russia in 1860. And you already see it proliferating all over the place, anti-clericalism, the terminology and the idea and all of that. So therefore, he did not look at the church. And institutionally, the church was very separate with that caste, right, hereditary caste of clergy, white clergy, with that separate organization. They had their own courts and so forth and so on. Only in the late 60s does he begin to look at the church and really looks for a very specific form of orthodoxy, which is this counter-institutional elderhood, right? The Zosima paradigm of the spiritual elder who now represents true spiritual purity. And the most frequent term on that list that I showed you before is elderhood or elder. Okay, thank you very much. I hope this was up to boring.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.